So yesterday we looked at the first of the three trainings. We looked at what's called Shila, ethics, morality. We looked at the five precepts, the five great ethical training principles. And we also had a little look at this word kusala. Kusala meaning skillful and akusala meaning unskillful. And Buddhism is concerned with the development, with the cultivation of skillful mental states. You know, all Buddhist practice is concerned with that, if it really is true Buddhist practice. In other words, states of mind free of greed, hatred and delusion. They are, if you have greed, hatred and delusion and so on, you're in an unskillful state. If it's free of those, it's skillful. And more positively, if one's mind is filled by contentment or generosity, friendliness, loving kindness, clarity, awareness, even some wisdom, then it's a skillful state, kusala. Now I'm reminding you of this because Buddhist meditation is just this. Sangharakshita has defined meditation in Buddhism as the uninterrupted stream of skillful mental states. That's what one's really aiming to do in meditation, to develop an uninterrupted stream of skillful mental states. While you're sitting there, you're looking to develop skillfulness in your mind. So in a way, if you get lost in meditation, not quite sure what to do, that's very easy to come back to. You're looking to develop skillful states. So in meditation, we're concerned to actually to cultivate an intense concentration on skillfulness. It's a continuous, you know, not just a continuous flow of skillful mental states, but an intensive concentration on skillful mental states, or an absorption in skillful mental states. So the flow is going on, but there's this very deep absorption in skillfulness. And at first, of course, it takes quite an effort to do this. We need to, at first, consciously develop such states, particularly states of awareness, states of positive emotion. And this is why we use meditation practices. Eventually, when we get deeply into meditation, these deeper states just arise naturally and spontaneously. But at first, as it were spontaneously, but at first we actually have to do something. And this is where meditation practices come in. And meditation practices generally go under the heading of bhavana. Bhavana means literally making to become, cultivation, development, as in metta bhavana. In that practice, we're consciously developing loving kindness. Out of the friendliness that we already have, we're developing a greater concentration on friendliness. We're turning it into metta, into loving kindness for all beings. And in the mindfulness of breathing, in that meditation practice, we're consciously developing mindfulness awareness. So methods of meditation in Buddhism, and there are many, many methods of meditation, are concerned to assist in the cultivation of skillful states. That's what their aim is. And eventually, the concentration and involvement with such states becomes so strong, it's so thoroughgoing, bhavana becomes samadhi. Meditation becomes samadhi, which is usually translated as concentration. But it's concentration of a very special kind. This is why I'm deliberately using the original terms like samadhi. Usually by concentration we mean the strong focus of part of our mind on a particular topic. For example, it might be, you know, really having to use reason and intellect in order to pass an examination, you know, for example. Samadhi is very different in this context of meditation. It's the concentration, or rather really the integration of the whole of our being on and in skillfulness. On and in skillfulness. So our whole being, if you like, all the energies of our being, all the aspects of our being, heights and depths, conscious mind and unconscious mind, if you like, are dwelling in, are flowing as skillfulness. You're fully mindful, for example. You're fully engaged in mindfulness. Or you're fully in loving kindness. There's nothing sort of left out. And these are very, very rich states of being indeed when you attain these. There's not just one kind of samadhi. There's a whole range of states called dhyanas. Absorptions is probably the best translation, or they could be translated as superconscious states. And there's also the brahmaviharas, the divine abidings. That's another way of looking at these states. And I'm going to look at these, going to describe them a bit later on to give you some feeling for them, give you some little hint of them. But before these states can open up, we'll need to do quite a bit of work in meditation, using the methods, the practices, using the methods and the practices. In particular, we'll need to work on freeing the mind of the mental hindrances. That's what we'll need to work on. We need to purify the mind of the five mental hindrances. I'm using this word work quite deliberately. It might not be a term that you would associate with meditation. But that's the traditional term for meditation methods in Buddhism, meditation practices. The traditional term is kamatana. Kamatana. Which means literally place of work. Mindfulness of breathing is your place of work. Your place of work is the work of learning to be mindful of breath. Metta-bhavana is a kamatana, a place of work. Your work is the development, the cultivation of loving kindness. Obviously, it's a different kind of work than we're used to thinking of work, but it is work nonetheless. I say this because sometimes people think that meditation is simply about relaxation. That's all it is. You're just relaxing and nothing else. And that there's no place for work, for effort. Well, yes, relaxation is important. We need to be relaxed when we meditate. You need to be relaxed to do the work. But work we most definitely have to do in meditation practice. It's perhaps more like work in the alchemical sense. In alchemy, they talk about the work, the great work of transmuting copper or base metal into gold. That's the alchemist's work, the great work. Well, in the same way, that's what we're doing in meditation. It's the great work is transforming the base metal of the ordinary human mind into the gold of the Buddha mind. But it is most definitely work. So place of work. So let's look then at the five mental hindrances that we need to rid the mind of, free the mind of, purify the mind of. It's important to be able to name them, first of all, to identify them. Half the battle is actually seeing what's going on and saying, this is a hindrance. This is in the way. This is actually obstructing my growth, my development. These are definitely hindrances and barriers. They're going to disintegrate my mind and they're going to prevent movement into the depths of meditation. Sometimes hindrances of all kinds in Buddhism are sort of personified as a sort of demon figure called Mara. Mara is a sort of personification of all the things in our mind, in our consciousness, that block and prevent and hinder our growth. It's very important when you're dealing with demons to be able to name them. When you get them to tell you their name, you have power over them. It means when you don't know their name, when you can't nail them, you're in trouble. So this is why it's important to name the hindrance. That's you. I've seen you. This is the traditional way of the ancient Buddhist monks dealing with Mara. They don't have a great sort of fight with him like you get in. Mara's not really like the devil in Christianity. He's not a sort of force of evil. And he's not dealt with by great sort of wrestling matches. All they do, all the Buddhist monks, the Buddha and his disciples do, when Mara comes along, they say, "You are seen." And then he just goes away. As soon as he's seen as a hindrance, he goes. So it's half the battle to really fully name the hindrance. You might have to do a bit more work after that, but half the battle is naming. So let's go through these hindrances. And each of the hindrances is likened to water in different states. It's trying to sort of give you a picture of what the mind's like when we have that hindrance. So the first is desire for sense experience. Desire for sense experience. So there you are. You're getting into your meditation. You're beginning to perhaps focus on your breath. You're getting a little bit poised. You're moving into it a few minutes in, maybe a little bit deeper. Things are coming together. And then you just sort of think, ah, it's nearly dinner time. You know, maybe this is happening in the afternoon. Ah, good. Or nearly breakfast time. And before you know it, you're sort of thinking about eating. And you've left the breath. Or a beautiful person will come into your mind. There you are, you're really poised. And then you remember that beautiful person that you saw on the train coming up, or you're going back to. And before you know it, you're off on some fantasy or other. And your meditation, your concentration goes. You know, you're all over the place. So watch for that. Very often, this in its desire for sense experience, it's pulling you away from going deeper into meditation. That's the point. It's not about going, oh, I'm a terribly bad person because I have this desire. It's not the point. It's pulling you away from going deeper in meditation. It's much grosser than the sort of subtle, if you like, subtler, deeper pleasure that you get in meditation. The mind that has desire for sense experience in it is likened to water that's mixed with brightly coloured dyes. Interesting image, you know. You'd think, oh, that look, water, that colour would be so fantastic. Bright yellow or bright blue or bright red. Well, that might be, but not as good as really clear, limpid, sparkling water that's clear, that has no sort of colour in it at all. So watch for that. Watch for desire for sense experience. Secondly, the second mental hindrance is anger, ill will, hatred, any of those. There you are in the metta bhavana, you're flowing along nicely, you've got going in the first stage, you thought of your good friend and it's really beginning to build, and you know, even the neutral person, you're seeing there something in them. And then you come to the fourth stage and it starts off fine because you've got all the momentum of what went before, and then you think, they did that to me, and they did that, and they did that, and I don't like their face or their trousers. And before you know it, you're sort of boiling with rage. You know, you're getting really out, you're seething in relation to them. You know, meditation is wrecked, absolutely wrecked. You know, you're just all over the place again. And the mind, when it's in this state, is likened to boiling water. You know, water on the boil. It's spitting and so on. So watch for that. Watch for that. Be vigilant for anger or ill will or resentment. Just watch for it. And if it starts coming up, take measures. Thirdly, there's restlessness and anxiety. There you are. You're sitting. You're getting going, but you can't settle. You don't feel comfortable. Actually, there's nothing probably any different in your posture from earlier on that day when it might have been fantastically comfortable, but suddenly you're uncomfortable. Just put my leg there, or I just do that, and then I'll be all right. And you know, you feel little tickling sensations, you have to scratch, and oh, what's that noise over there? And you know, you're really sort of shuffling around. And even some forms of pain can just be a kind of restlessness. So you're sort of, you know, you're physically restless. But then that's the gross form. But then there's the mental restlessness and anxiety. Your mind is just buzzing. It just won't settle. It's jumping from one thing to another. You know, like they call it the butterfly mind, just going from one flower to the next, or the monkey chattering in the flowering tree, just leaping around. And there might even be some anxiety kicking in there. You know, you are meditating, and then you think, oh, did I post that letter? Oh, did I send that email? Have I done this? Have I done that? And then, well, if I haven't done that, I haven't done that, and I've got to do that. And before you know it, you're planning, you're off, you're way off planning. I know some people in meditation, they spend a lot of time sort of planning when they're supposed to be meditating. They just, I mean, an architect friend of mine, sort of, they've just built something in their head, something like that. Well, that is all, it might be a wonderful exercise, but it's restlessness. You're not engaging in the meditation. You might turn out to build something fantastic, but that is not what you're supposed to be doing in the mindfulness of breathing. What you're supposed to be building there is mindfulness. Sometimes the restlessness can be so much that you just want to get up and leave. You know, you just can't. It's like you've got ants in your pants. You know, you just want to get up and go. And this is like water. The mind, when it's filled with this, is like water whipped up into waves. You know, it's just the wind on it all the time. It's just really disturbed. Fourthly, the opposite really of restlessness and anxiety is sloth and torpor. There you are, sitting in meditation, you're focusing on the breath, or you're developing loving kindness, and then you just start to feel really sleepy and dozy. And the weird thing is, you probably had a little sleep beforehand, you know, before you went into meditate, but you're just really thick and dull and turgid, and, you know, your energy just feels blocked and dull. It's fascinating sometimes when you, if you're leading meditation between the stages, you know, you look around and you see that, you know, very fighters like that. Surat's got a little phrase for this, noddy in Toyland. I don't know where the Toyland comes from. It's like you're noddy, and you're like a sort of bouncy toy. You're not necessarily that tired. You're just really dull, and maybe you just frankly don't want to engage, but you're too dishonest to admit that. So your being kind of finds a way of not engaging, especially if it's something really sort of, you know, difficult. You just fall asleep. And it really does feel like as though you're thick, muddy water. And this is the way what the Buddha likens this to. The mind, when it's full of sloth and torpor, is like thick, stagnant water, thick with black mud. I mean, you see things like that around here in the marshes. It, you know, maybe it's a bit smelly as well. Fifthly, there's doubt and indecision. Here you are in your meditation, focusing on the breath, but then you start thinking, it's not working, I'll do something else. You've only been sitting there for 5 minutes. It's not working. No, I'll do the metta bhavana. Oh, that's not working either. Oh, no, it's not working. Maybe I'll just sit. That's not working. Maybe I need a different kind of meditation. Maybe this kind of Buddhist meditation isn't for me. In fact, maybe meditation is a complete waste of time, and so on and so on and so on. And this is all doubt and indecision. It's all manifestations of an unwillingness to commit ourselves to the meditation practice. And maybe there's even something in us that doesn't want to commit ourselves really to anything. And when the mind is in this state of doubt and indecision, it's like water that is choked with weeds. You sometimes see that. You see a stream and it's just completely sort of, it can't flow properly because it's just choked up with weeds. The weeds are really inhibiting the flow and might even block it completely. So in the same way, doubt and indecision just chokes the free flow of the mind. So we need to get to grips with this lot, these hindrances. Like I say, first off, really notice them, clock them, really get them. And that is a hindrance, and that is going to get in my way. You know, don't, you know, if it starts to come in, don't entertain it. You know, name it. this is damaging. Yeah. Of course, these things can be terribly seductive as well. I mean, that sleepy state, you think, oh, it's have a little sleep. Yeah. Oh. You know what I mean? It just slides in, or desire looks so bright in your mind, that thing. And but before you know it, you're just off. You're just away. So you've really got to clock it. If you can, in a way, the simplest thing to do, if you're noticing, you might just sort of notice them, they're sort of trying to get in. There you are, concentrating on the breath or the metta, or you're just sitting in awareness, and you notice these things trying to get in, and you just don't give them attention. Just come back to the object of the meditation. Just come back to it quickly. You know, that's you know, in some ways the best way of dealing with what's happening. But then there are antidotes. There are actually a number of antidotes given for dealing with these hindrances. So let's go through these. The first of one that I want to mention is called cultivating the sky-like attitude, the sky-like mind. Actually, I think this is a very subtle way of dealing with the hindrances. And you can only really employ it when the mind is already very clear and positive, and you're getting more deeply into meditation. It's when the mind is sort of clear and open and concentrated. And what you notice is you can see the hindrances coming, you know, sort of a mile off, as it were. Your mind has that much sort of space. You can sort of sense or see it happening. And you just let it pass. You just, as it were, watch it, if you like. So whatever's arising, you just see it as a cloud going through the space of your mind. And you don't really do anything. You don't push it away. You don't entertain it. You just see it float past. But I say, you really, or it assumes that you've already got some momentum in meditation for this to happen. You've got some space in mind for this to happen. If you haven't got any space in mind, you usually what will happen is that you just, you're probably in the grip of the hindrances and you don't know it if you try to do this. But it's this wonderful sort of state of positive awareness, bright awareness, like the brilliant sky, and you're just seeing these things arise and pass away. And actually the awareness is so bright, it just dissipates. It just sort of, as it were, destroys the hindrance before it can get a grip, because your awareness is so bright. But like I say, this will come when you're up and running in your practice. You can usually do this at the end of the mindfulness of breathing, or the metta-bhavana, or at the end of the puja or something like that, when the mind is very, very positive already. If the hindrances are deeper, there are other methods. So there's reflecting on the consequences of the hindrance. You can reflect on what will happen if the hindrance gets a grip on you. If you've got doubt going on in you, you've got to reflect, well, if I let this in, I just won't meditate. I just won't engage in anything. So, you know, be decisive in relation to it. If it's ill will, if you're just starting to boil with anger, you've just got to quickly think through where the hindrance is going to lead. You know, if you're starting to have those thoughts, you've got to ask yourself, where is this going to end up? I'm just going to be sitting here seething. So reflecting on the consequences, again, it's you need a quick-mindedness with this to catch the hindrance and see, where will I go if I have this? Where will I end up right now? You know, I'll either fall asleep, or I'll just be, you know, restless, or I'll just be in the grip of ill will. See through it. You could even take it further if you want to and think, well, if this gets a grip outside of meditation, where will it end up? I mean, if it's ill will, I could end up, you know, really falling out with people and so on. Thirdly, there's cultivating the positive opposite. So if ill will arises in whatever meditation, immediately do the metta-bhavana. So even if you're doing the mindfulness of breathing and ill will starts, immediately respond with loving kindness to that person. Just go straight to loving kindness. You know, quick-mindedness. One of the things about meditation is you're learning a quickness, a fleetness, a responsiveness, a creativity of mind in relation to what's happening. If there's doubt and indecision, be decisive. As soon as that really snidey voice of doubt and indecision comes in, just say, no, out. And be really decisive and really commit to the practice. So I'm just going to engage with this, whatever happens. If you're slothful, open your eyes. You know, really open your eyes. Straighten your back. You know, rouse energy as much as you can. Obviously, if you're meditating with other people, you have to do that fairly quietly. If you're on your own, you might do other things. Mr. Chen, one of this Chinese hermit who was a teacher of Sangharakshita, said, you know, sloth and torpor really needs to be dealt with extreme measures. And he advocated, if sloth and torpor is happening, run round your shrine room chanting mantras really loudly. Because, you know, you don't want to get in the grip of sloth and torpor. Well, you can't do that here when you're meditating with other people. But that's what he recommended. You know, do something, you know, physical, if you like. Do prostrations. But just rouse your energies. Don't just sort of sit there dozing off. If desire arises, desire for sense experience, well, cultivate the positive opposite of really getting interested and fascinated by the meditation subject. So really look, you know, at the breath and get fascinated in it, get interested in it. Really try to develop a much more sort of subtle awareness that is interested in that process of breathing, which is extraordinarily beautiful, actually. Obviously, try to do this right at the start of the meditation. Or the beauty of metta. You know, metta is a very, very beautiful practice when you get into it, when you dwell in loving kindness. It's far superior than any, you know, physical beauty that you could come across. Far more lovely. Fourthly, and this is going to sound perhaps controversial, this forcible suppression. This might sound strange, but what it means is that you just don't allow the hindrance to take hold. It's quite conscious. You're not going to damage yourself or anything like this. It's not repression, which is an unconscious process. You just decide, I'm not going to give in to this. You know, out, demons, out, to quote the old Edgar Broughton song. Cultural reference there. You know, really take your mind in hand, if you like. I'm just not going to give in to this. I'm just not going to have it. And you might actually spend a whole meditation doing that. And that is actually worth doing, you know, really getting a grip of yourself. And I'm just not going there. I'm just not getting into that. You might have to sit there with your eyes open. You know, you might just have to sit there. You know, maybe even have to keep a mantra going in your mind or something like that. I'm just not going to get indulge this state of ill will or whatever it is. Or I'm not going to spend another 40 minutes of sleep as I've been doing for the last, you know, 5 meditations. You know, I'm gonna be awake, you know, and things like that. I mean, we don't teach this, but some of the old Buddhist masters were really tough on this sort of thing. I won't go into some of the things they did because you might think you might get the wrong idea. But, you know, just really sort of toughing it out. And sometimes you have to do that in meditation. You know, you have to tough it out. It's not the whole story, and you need to have all the other things going on as well, you know, the very positive things. But sometimes you might go through a phase where that's necessary. There is sometimes the view that, oh, you've got to be so careful not to be willful. You know, you've got to be so careful. Well, there is a danger with being willful, but hey, thinking about it, we're willful about all sorts of things which we never do anything about. I mean, as soon as you have craving and you act on it, you're being extraordinarily willful. And that doesn't seem to be a problem, does it? You know, that I'm going to have this regardless of the effect on other people. Well, that's being willful, extraordinarily willful. But when it comes to the cultivation of virtue, suddenly willfulness is a problem. I find that very sort of devious in a way. But sometimes you do have to use will in the sense of gathering up your energies and really bringing yourself to what to what you're doing. Sometimes in the morning I have to use will to get out of bed. If I didn't use will, I'd stay in bed. I want to get out of bed. I want to stay sleeping. So come on, up, move, get on the cushion, engage, drag yourself onto the evolutionary path. Stop staying in the sort of sludge and mud of the primordial swamp and start getting real, So you might need to do that sometimes. It isn't always. Can I invite you to? If I talk like that to myself, I'd have real problems. Would you like to get up this morning? No. Can I invite you to? So, now, it might be that none of these work with a hindrance. You might have such a sort of deep-rooted hindrance. That you've tried everything, and the thing is still there. It's still sort of grinding away. So what do you do? Is there anything you can do? Well, what the Buddha says is, he says that you go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. We have that going for refuge section in the puja. And I find this very interesting. It's as if you're recommitting yourself to the practice of meditation. It might be that you've spent 40 minutes in a meditation just completely assailed by hindrances all over the place. Well, then it's very, you've tried your best, but these things have really kind of, they've kind of beaten you, or you haven't gone further. At the end of the meditation, it doesn't matter, it might have gone like this, that doesn't matter, I'm just going to recommit myself to the practice of meditation and to the path of spiritual development. I'm going to go for refuge to that. It's very important to do that. Never leave a meditation sort of feeling really sort of disheartened and really sorry for yourself and, I can't do it, I'm a miserable worm and, everybody else can gain enlightenment but me, I'm going to be left in samsara and all the rest of it. Don't do that. Just think, all right, it's been rubbish. Doesn't matter. I'm up for this. I'm going to do this. And recommit yourself so that the next time you come to meditate, you've got that, that commitment behind you. Very, very important. Very, very important. It's very, very important that we don't get into this. That it's a form of conceit, as far as Buddhism is concerned, that we can't do it. We're sort of uniquely flawed. We're used to thinking of conceit as being an attitude of superiority to others. But there's another kind of conceit, which is we're inferior to others and we can't progress spiritually. That's a fixed view of yourself. So it's a conceit. What's so special about you? What's so special about me that you think you can't do it? Of course we can. There's another kind of conceit, by the way, which is the view that we're all equal, but we won't go into that. Sometimes the hindrance is related to what we've been doing beforehand, so it's worth looking at that. If you're talking a lot before you go into meditation, maybe excited talking or any kind of talking, don't be surprised if you're really restless in meditation, if you're really buzzy. It's good to practice silence before meditation. It would be a good practice when we go over to the shrine room in the afternoon and the evening to be silent. Well, as soon as we start walking over to the shrine room, especially as we get into the stupa courtyard, just stop talking so everything starts to calm down. You might have all sorts of hindrances kind of going on if you've been talking just before meditation, because all sorts of things might have been stirred up. So it's good to have some silence before meditation. Sometimes you might be sleepy in meditation because you haven't had a little rest before meditation. This is emphasised. I mean, the classic texts on meditation, which are usually for monks. Although lay people practice them in the East, they'd say, well, after your meal, go and have your noonday rest And it's then, and after you've digested your meal, then you meditate. Is the way they talk, that you have a little sort of siesta. You make sure, so you're not trying to meditate when you're sleepy and you're digesting your food. So it might be, and the afternoon sit can be a very sleepy meditation, it might be worthwhile just going and lying down for, you know, 10 minutes or something beforehand, so that you're really fresh when you come to meditate. Or just sit quietly. Sometimes we're restless or sleepy because our posture isn't very good. You know, if we're sort of hunched over, we might get very sleepy, or if we're too... You know, if we're too up, it can lead to a sort of restlessness, and we might need to look at our posture. It might be that we're restless because we've had a cup of coffee before we meditated. Well, you know, don't be surprised if you're all over the place if you've had, you know, if you've got some caffeine in you before you meditate. So prepare well, have quiet time, and it's good to have a shrine. You know, it's good to have a place where you meditate, so you've got the right atmosphere. Do some chanting beforehand, kind of rouse your energies, your inspiration. Preparation is really half the battle, maybe more than half. Also, regularity, a rhythm to your life is important with meditation. This is why the routine on a retreat is really important. It's not just a good way of organising everybody on the retreat and being able to do things. It's also a virtue. It's contributing to the whole rhythm, if you like, of spiritual practice. Everything comes together around the routine, you know, and at the centre of that routine are the important things in life: meditation, study, puja, and so on. When you're at home, definitely aim to meditate at the same time every day in a dedicated place. All that helps. In time, meditation will deepen. You know, if we can deal with the hindrances, if we engage with them well, if we're meditating regularly, if we go on retreat, the hindrances drop away and the mind will enter samadhi, absorption. Which isn't just one state, but an unfolding series of states. And these are called the dhyanas, which means, can be translated as something like super conscious states or absorptions. They're above the ordinary state of mind that we inhabit. But they're an unfolding from that. They're related to ordinary mind, if you like, but they're an unfolding, an expansion of that. What's going on in the dhyanas in samadhi is that all our different energies are coming together, becoming integrated, they're becoming very refined, and consciousness is becoming transformed into something intensely skillful, intensely wholesome, intensely positive. And there's nothing unskillful and negative within the dhyanas. When you're in a dhyana, you're in a wholly positive state of mind. The mind is wholly absorbed in the good in a very powerful way. And it's that these states are very refreshing, very uplifting, inspiring. And they're described quite a lot in the Buddhist scriptures. They're given some descriptions. One of them is in terms of their different mental components, which is quite technical, which I'm not going to give you at the moment. But there's another one where the Buddha uses really rather homely sort of similes, homely for his time and place. So I'm going to use those similes that the Buddha used, and also Sangharakshita's everyday descriptions and characterizations of them. So the Buddha said the first dhyana, the first absorption, first superconscious state, is like taking soap powder and mixing it with water until you have a perfect ball of soap. They had soap powder in ancient India. Apparently it was from a particular plant. And they would form it into soap balls. I think the Buddha in the simile says, supposing an expert bath attendant or bath attendant's apprentice takes some soap powder and blends it with water, mixes it with water, so that all the water is completely absorbed in the soap powder, so you have a perfect ball of soap. Presumably these attendants were by the tank of water and giving these balls of soap to people who came along. Anyway, so the Buddha said the first dhyana is just like that. Just like soap and water perfectly mixed. So what you've got going on here is the coming together of our energies around the skillful, around the positive. This is what you're doing in meditation. You're bringing everything together around the skillful and the positive. There's a sense of ease and tension, a sense of happiness. There's a little bit even of thought very much in the background, maybe just commenting very, very gently on what's happening, very sort of spaciously. But there's just this wonderful sense of poise, of coming together. Sangharakshita calls this the stage of integration. And he also characterised it as the healthy human state. He said, you know, on one occasion he said, well, if we were really living as human beings ought to live, this would be the state we'd be in all the time. This state of ease and concentration and integration and happiness. You can even be in this state outside of meditation. You can even be doing very simple tasks in this state. I mean, you wouldn't be able to do it if you were, you know, doing accounts or you were on the internet or something like that. Maybe just doing very simple tasks like, I don't know, gardening or washing or something like that. Very straightforward. You could be in this state of the first dhyana. Because there isn't any, you know, complex thought. So that's the first dhyana, the state of integration. The second dhyana, the Buddha said, is you have a great tank of water. You have, used to have this in ancient India, you still have them, these tanks, these public tanks that have been built round a pool, usually square tanks, you know, great stone things, amazing things. So you've got this tank of water, and it's continually being refreshed and replenished by a subterranean spring that's just welling up all the time, just refreshing and purifying that tank of water. A really lovely image. So the Buddha said the second dhyana, the second absorption, is like that. So here what's going on, it seems, is that this higher state of consciousness has sort of opened up to something even deeper. You're sort of accessing a deeper source of, if you like, energy, a deeper source of consciousness that's flowing into you and inspiring you and energising you from a very, very deep source. So Sangharakshita calls this the stage of inspiration. The stage of inspiration. The Buddha's sort of describing it as though it's coming from the depths. But Sangharakshita believes it can also be experienced in a different way, as coming from the heights. You might be in meditation and have a sense of something, as it were, coming down. You might have a sense of either being borne up by the higher state of consciousness, or as though something's reaching down and raising you. It's, as it were, all you, but it's as if you're encountering deeper or higher aspects of consciousness as it expands. So yes, the state of inspiration. This is a very blissful state indeed. You know, you really do feel as though you're being taken outside of yourself when this is happening. At the same time, you remain very serene when this is happening. And in this state, there is no discursive thought at all. There's no mental chatter, not even in the first dhyana. You've got this very slight commentary on what's going on. In the second, that goes, that vanishes, that dissolves. It's not a blank state. It's very, very vivid and alive, very present. But you're just completely absorbed in this inspiration, being raised up or born up. So Sangharakshita also called this on one occasion the poetic state, or the prophetic state, or even the artistic state, whether or not you're involved in prophecy, which I'm sure None of us are. I think it meant prophetic in the sort of Blakean sense. Whether or not we're involved in poetry or art or whatever, you feel in touch with sort of wellsprings, if you like, of creativity. That's what's going on here. Sangharakshita has said, and I don't think he's ever sort of retracted this, that these first two dhyanas are actually easy to achieve if we regularly meditate and we have the right conditions in which to do it. If that hasn't been your experience, don't worry, it doesn't mean that you're not progressing spiritually or anything like that. But I find it quite inspiring to hear that these are sort of available. You know, very often I think with these states of mind, it can be a lot to do with not just our meditation but our lifestyle. You know, modern lifestyle can be so busy, so complex. You know, it's very, very difficult to get deeply into meditation. There are further states. The third dhyana, the third absorption, the Buddha likens to a great lake of lotus flowers, obviously in water, and the leaves and the petals are thoroughly saturated by the water. Leaves and petals, the water's thoroughly saturating them all. You know, sort of imagine, you know, our pond out there and the water's sort of just saturating the lilies there, the leaves and the flowers, everything. Here, the higher state of consciousness is, as it were, all pervasive. Before it was as if it was, as it, you know, kind of internal, although you've got in the second dhyana a sense of something beyond you. But here it's as if it's not just inside you, it's outside you as well. There's this all-pervasive concentration, absorption, bliss, happiness, very refined, very, very subtle. It's as if the higher state of consciousness is sort of pervading your entire world, not just you as a sort of separate person. You can have a sense as though you're sort of floating through space, and it's as if this higher state is sort of inside you and outside you, like a bubble floating through space. The air's on the inside and the air's on the outside, and there's just this very thin, transparent, gossamer layer of awareness between the two, that's sort of transparent. For very, very light, like thistledown, floating through space. Sangharakshita characterises this state as the state of permeation, because obviously the higher state of consciousness is permeating your whole being. He's also described it on one occasion as the mystical state, I suppose because the great mystics in the different traditions, you know, very often have this sense of sort of dissolving, if you like, into something beyond them. Then the fourth dhyana, higher still, the image that the Buddha uses here is a man, and obviously this is ancient India, on a very hot day, takes a bath in one of those tanks or pools, so he gets very cool in doing that, comes out and he takes a clean, pure white sheet and just wraps himself in that white sheet and just sits there. So the fourth dhyana is like that. Here the higher state of consciousness isn't just sort of within you and around you, it's as it were radiating. That white sheet is perhaps the image there, it's protecting. It's actually affecting the world in some way. It's a very powerful state of consciousness, the fourth dhyana. It's actually touching and affecting the world, and people can even maybe feel it, even though they don't know quite what it is, something sort of emanating out. So Sangharakshita calls this the state of radiation. The higher state is radiating outwards, protecting you and affecting the world. So he's also characterised it as the state of the magician, in the sense of the siddha, because it's said, this particular on the basis of this particular absorption, you can develop so-called psychic powers. You can travel great distances, read people's minds, all that sort of thing. Not that in Buddhism you're encouraged to do that, but really what's being got at here is that this higher state of consciousness is touching, affecting the environment around you. So all these states, what's going on in them, you're naturally concentrated, your whole being is unified, they're very blissful, very calm, and you're at ease. And your consciousness is thoroughly transformed in these states. And I'm mentioning them to just show you the range of meditation as far as Buddhism is concerned, just to give you a sense of them. And also because of their intrinsic importance. But it's very important not to try and grasp at these states. Very, very important not to try and get into them. It's not a good idea to go into the shrine and think, I'm going to get into that fourth dhyana. Sounds good. It doesn't work like that. When you go in to meditate, you engage with the actual meditation practice. You work on dissolving the hindrances. But what can happen is these states might start to open up. You might feel it happening, and you might be able to relate it to some of the descriptions I've given. And if you feel that beginning to happen, if you feel yourself becoming concentrated, you have to work much more subtly. It might be that you can just let go of the meditation subject when you feel that higher state arising, and just start opening up to it. Just, as it were, let go into it. If the hindrances start to come back, well, then you go back to the method or something like that. But it could be that through your meditation, the fruits of the meditation are arising, and you need to be open to that. This is why we have this just sitting meditation in the evening. That's an opportunity to open up the more, as it were, receptive mode of meditation. And it's in that opening up that dhyana might arise. So you need to be aware of this dimension, these deeper states opening up. They might not come in precisely this way. This is a way of describing them. Everybody's an individual. Everybody's entry into these states might be different. So they might be experienced a little bit differently. But there will be common factors. Some people can be very visionary and have all sorts of visions. And when you talk to them, they're obviously having some sort of dhyana experience. But not everybody's like that. And it doesn't mean that the visionary type is infinitely more spiritually superior than, us of us who just can't see a thing. So it's important not to fixate on these things. If they arise, enjoy them and let them go. Don't attach yourself to them. I have known people who've had a sort of dhyana experience or a spiritual experience, and it can become a major distraction. It becomes the thing they need to get back to. And if they can't get back to it, they get very upset and very depressed. Or it becomes a sort of badge that they wear and go around and tell everybody who wants to listen, I've had a major spiritual experience. There you are, just about to eat your potatoes, and they want to tell you about their major spiritual experience. Well, this just becomes, it's obviously just become a sort of, a source of attachment. It's like, my new car, my new computer. I'm the person who had the spiritual experience. Yeah, it's very important if you've had deep experiences, but if you have them, talk about them, to somebody who's going to really listen well at the right time, and take them seriously. But they've gone, they've happened, and they've had a big effect on your life. But those experiences have gone. So now we are here where we are, and we move on engaging with the stages of the path of practice. So we need an attitude of appreciation, but also one of letting go and not fixating, which is what appreciation really is, as opposed to attachment. Now, these dhyanas are just stages on the path. They're not the end of the path. And there's another set of higher states which are described, which I also just want to mention. And these look at higher states in terms of your emotional attitude and emotional response to others. So they're very, very important. And these are called the Brahmaviharas, the divine abidings, or they're also called the immeasurables, because they're vast, open-ended states that, yes, you can, you know, you just continually unfold in. So the first of these is loving kindness. So this is metta. This is what we're cultivating in the metta bhavana practice. So this is friendliness taken to its highest possible pitch of intensity and felt for all beings. So the end of the metta bhavana is to abide always in loving kindness. The Buddha says that the end of the metta bhavana practice, the metta vihara, the metta brahma vihara, is when you're able to walk and sit and lie down, whatever you do, in other words, with loving kindness. If the loving kindness is always there, then you are in the highest state. That's the end of loving kindness. I say this because recently I've heard people say things like, well, I think I've come to the end of loving kindness. And you say, all right, so all day long, loving kindness. No, but I've come to the end of the metta bhavana. Well, how have you come to the end of the metta bhavana? The end of the metta bhavana is all day long loving kindness, naturally. Second Brahma Vihara is the Karuna Brahma Vihara, the abiding in compassion, which isn't pity, it's a very different kind of emotion. This compassion arises when our metta, our loving kindness, encounters the suffering of others. Immediately it acts to alleviate that suffering. So when we're able to do that, we're in the divine abiding of compassion. Then thirdly, there's the divine abiding of sympathetic joy. This is the joy, the happiness that arises when you encounter the happiness of others. When you're in a state of loving kindness, when you come across the happiness of others, you're immediately glad and joyful, and you delight in that. You rejoice in that. You have that joyfulness. It's a very important state indeed. And of course, it's the opposite of cynicism and so on, the complete other end of that, cynicism and jealousy. It's a very important state. So when we're having that response of joy at the, when we encounter the happiness of others, we're then abiding in the mudita vihara. Then there's equanimity, upeksha. There's different ways you can explain this one. One explanation is that when you have equal love, equal compassion, equal joy, the same love, compassion and joy for everyone, then you're then abiding in equanimity. It's this sameness of response. Regardless of their ups and downs, you know, they might change in all sorts of ways. They go up, they go down. And you still have loving kindness, you still have compassion, you still have joy, whatever's happening, then you're abiding in this equanimity, the divine abiding of equanimity. So these are some of the Brahma Viharas. So there's another way of looking at these higher states of consciousness. And you are very absorbed when you get into these states. So these are some of the higher states of consciousness that open up to us when we meditate regularly and when we go on retreat. And there's two aspects, if you like, we can draw out of them, if you want to sort of boil it down. One aspect we can call integration, the drawing together, the gathering together of all our energies. It's concentration in that sense, around what is skillful. So there's integration. Very important that we gather ourselves, gather everything. It's very hard to develop spiritually, you know, if our consciousness is divided. You know, we make a decision to do something one night and the next morning there's been a revolution within consciousness and we don't want to do it the next day. So when we, you know, through these practices, we integrate. We integrate around our spiritual ideals, around meditation. Very, very important. The other aspect is cultivation of positive emotion towards others. Love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, and all their subtle shades, empathy, sympathy, etc., etc. We need to develop that. Very, very difficult to have a spiritual life without positive emotion. In fact, no spiritual life without positive emotion. It's the sort of lifeblood, if you like, of a Buddhist life, positive emotion. The idea that you can dispense with emotion in a spiritual life, you know, and some presentations of Buddhism can make it sound like that, is completely absurd. Emotion is where all your motivation is, all your energy is, all your imaginings are. So that all needs to be engaged. And you do this through meditation. So integration and positive emotion are the root, the base of meditation practice. They're the foundations of meditation. And it's why we emphasise in our own tradition the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. Mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana create integration and positive emotion within us. Practicing those, we develop those two really, you know, those two so important foundations of spiritual practice. When perfected, when they're well developed, we attain, yes, you can call it samadhi, but there's another term that's used here, and that's shamatha. Shamatha, sorry for all these terms, I hope I'm not getting too technical, but you can read up all about this in some of Sangharakshita's book. Shamatha, which literally means calm abiding. Calm abiding comes about through dwelling in the dhyanas, dwelling in these brahma-viharas, these divine abidings. It's shamatha is the mind that's highly concentrated, very calm and bright with positive emotion. That's shamatha. And it's a very, very important stage in spiritual life and spiritual practice. However, states of shamatha, the state of samadhi, positive emotion integration can be attained and they can be lost. And they can be attained and they can be lost. And they can be attained again and they can be lost. And you might find this in your own spiritual life, that maybe one day you were in the dhyanas and the next day you were very, very far from the dhyanas. Maybe one day you were full of loving kindness and the next day you were a long way from loving kindness. These states of samadhi, of shamatha, are not a permanent attainment. They're very, very, very important, but they don't represent permanent transformation. There's lots of stories. You get this quite a lot in the Hindu tradition of Rishi so-and-so dwelling in the forest on the mountain, and he's so absorbed in meditation, in formless dhyanas, no less. You know, really out there meditation states. He stays in them for years, sitting there until his hair grows, you know, all over him, and an ant's nest builds itself over him. He's completely gone. Completely sort of, you know, out of it in dhyana. And then he finishes, the dhyana comes to an end, he steps up, he steps out, and what happens? He bumps into a beautiful maiden, and before you know it, he's set up shop on the ancient Indian equivalent of the Edgware Road, and he's forgotten all about the spiritual life. So that's what can happen. You know, we can attain these higher states, but we can lose them. I've seen it on retreat. I've seen people have dhyana experience, and it's fantastic, and it's, you rejoice, and then the next time you bump into them on the street somewhere, and they rather embarrassedly say, well, I've fallen, you know, I'm not really into all that anymore, whereas the last time you saw them, they were telling you about how they were going to gain enlightenment for all beings and so on. Well, this is because even these wonderful experiences where we think we've sort of made it, we've really got somewhere, they're impermanent. They're not a permanent attainment. For permanent spiritual attainment, we need, on the basis of our shamatha, on our positive emotion, our integration, and so on the basis of that, we need to develop wisdom. the third of the three trainings. We need to develop insight into the way things really are. We need to see things as they are, and when we really see things as they are, then we have permanent attainment. We enter the stream that just leads to nirvana. We need the meditation experience, we need the concentration and positive emotion in order to contemplate the Buddha's teachings which describe the way things are. If we didn't have the preparation in meditation, we wouldn't be able to do that concentration, contemplation successfully. But on the basis of our meditation, we then need to move towards wisdom. We need to train in wisdom by contemplating the Buddha's teaching. Because of our training in meditation, the teaching really goes in, goes into the depths. We're highly receptive to it, highly attuned to it, so that we really do see things as they are. And then there is permanent attainment. There's the wonderful story of Milarepa meditating early on in his career in the cave, you know, meditating, getting absorbed in dhyana, absorbed in meditation, reflecting on the Buddha's teaching in that context. But it was only when his bowl broke that he saw things as they are. The bowl broke, his one possession, and he said, "This is my teacher. This bowl that has broken is my teacher, because it's teaching me impermanence." The teaching of impermanence went right into his consciousness, seared into his consciousness, completely transforming his whole attitude to life, seeing everything as a teacher and a teaching, seeing everything, in other words, with the eye of wisdom. Well, he couldn't have done that, couldn't have seen that without being so absorbed in meditation and without reflecting on the Buddha's teachings. So yes, we need meditation practice to go deeper, but that's not the end. We need to train in wisdom, and we'll have a look at wisdom on Wednesday. Okay.